Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. It's probably something akin to sacrilege in St. Louis to speak in anything but glowing words about the Gateway Arch. But while our guest on today's program sees the arch as an architectural wonder known around the world that has drawn millions of tourists to St. Louis, he also sees some warts. As he puts it, in some ways, the arch accelerated urban decay and is, quote, an example of failed urban planning. Some monuments, he says, have more to tell us than meets the eye. His new book, The Gateway Arch, takes us back some seven decades to the very beginning of the arch story and brings us to today's effort on improving the arch grounds. Tracy Campbell is the author and professor of history at the University of Kentucky. Tracy, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
Tracy, I have to tell you, when I picked up the book and said we were doing a program on the arch, I said, oh no, not another arch story. But this is fascinating. You've done a terrific job on the history and certainly taught me a lot about that history.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I was fascinated by it, and if I can't relate it in a way that's fascinating, then I'm not sure why I should do it.
The whole story, it's been a long, long struggle going back a good many decades. But it was the 1930s when people began thinking about the riverfront.
Mm-hmm. They've been thinking about the riverfront for a while, but it really escalated in the Depression. And for people today, it's hard to think just how bad things were during the Depression. But we're talking about unemployment rates that are really humbling in today's standards. And, for white workers, the rates I've seen, 20-30% unemployment. For African Americans, it could reach 80% of either unemployed or underemployed. And the notion was, could there be some kind of economic development? And the question was, how do you get there? And that's where the story, I think, becomes interesting.
We should point out also, as long as we're talking about the Depression era, that there was some activity down in the riverfront. It's called Hooverville.
There was, but there was also, and the Post-Dispatch did this book, couldn't have been written without the Post-Dispatch kind of investigative work they did back in the 30s through the 60s. It was really first rate. And the notion was that this was derelict, blighted property, but they found a lot more economic activity in those 40 square blocks than we thought. And roughly 5,000 jobs were related to it. And these might not have been well-paying jobs, but there was economic activity there. You just can't think of this as blighted, empty property.
But ironically, that was going to go away at some point. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. What were they thinking in the mid-30s? What was the mindset at the time?
Well, the only place where you could get large amounts of money at the time were through federal projects like the WPA or, the NRA. And the city leaders tried to get some WPA projects on the riverfront. That didn't quite work out. It was when they decided to think about a presidential monument of some kind, that the New Deal and the administration thought that has some – that they got a bite with that. So they thought it would be natural to do something for Thomas Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase, the opening of the West. And so the city leaders, led by Mayor Bernard Dickman as well as Luther Ely Smith, thought about a $30 million project to redo the riverfront. And as I try to do in the book, $30 million doesn't impress people in today's standards. But at that time, that was a really large amount of money. That when I looked at the Pentagon, for example, that was complete in the early 40s. It cost $35 million to build the Pentagon. So this was an enormous expenditure of money. And how to get that money was, of course, part of the political process.
But they, in a sense, put the cart before the horse, did they not? They wanted the money, but no one was really quite sure exactly what they wanted to do.
Well, don't we do that everywhere?
That's another whole program.
Tear it down, and we'll figure out what to do later. Yeah. But, the point was to somehow get the money in here and to start some kind of economic development in an area that city leaders had designated as a place that needed economic development. And so that's how the ball got rolling.
Did they really want a memorial, or did they really want the land for other reasons? I'm thinking of the realtor aspect of your story.
Well, that's a part of the story that, I'm sure that I needed to really kind of delve into, and it took me a long time to try and understand why the great interest in this. Bernard Dickman, the mayor of St. Louis, loved St. Louis, and he wanted to make it better. I mean, he wasn't trying to take bribes or anything else, but he thought in terms of land and real estate and rental rates and property values. Right after the bond issue was passed in 1935, he proposed maybe a football stadium should be there. And over the many years, there were other ideas, whether it's a landing strip, housing projects, you know, shopping centers, whatever the case may be.
I have to stop you right here because my favorite part of your book was where you just a paragraph talking about the proposal that was viable for a while for a trailer park.
Well, that was the term they used. What they were thinking of is right after World War II, where could GIs, you know, live? And housing was kind of a national crisis. We had a national housing agency, for example. And so one of the notions was, why not use – at that time, it was now a gravel parking lot. Why not use it for some kind of housing project to house so many GIs who are going to be returning to the area?
Yeah. Well, I took us ahead of where you were. Continue on with the part about real estate developers having a special interest in this area.
Well, the way that the – here's how the deal worked. It's a $30 million project. The city is going to be responsible for a quarter of it. That's $7.5 million. The only way to get that is through floating a bond. The only way you can get a bond is through an election and have the democratic approval of the people. And you also need two-thirds. It's a huge, huge task to overcome. And as a historian, I always like stepping back and thinking, who's going to win, who's going to lose? You know, who's going to wind up on top? Who's going to feel cheated? Because not everyone gets to win. And with the federal government coming in and possibly buying up 40 square blocks through eminent domain, I started looking at the records to see who owned this property. And it came, you know, I come to find out there's a lot of banks, there's a lot of realty companies that own this property. And they could make money out from the gate well above appraisal. And then, of course, the land they owned around and adjacent to the property would go up because of the demand. And that's why a lot of people, particularly in Congress, are, you know, really opposed this whole idea, thinking that this was a real estate grab. William Lambertson, a very vocal opponent from Kansas, said that that's all it was. I think it's more complicated than that, but still it's good to see that there was the thinking behind that, the ideological and the political thinking behind it.
Part of which was to demolish these 40 square blocks and get rid of what they considered, I don't want to call it blighted necessarily, but unattractive,
right.
Just something they wanted to get rid of. And replace it with something else.
Something else, exactly. Yeah. And whether it's a monument or something else, you know, that was a 20-year process of thinking what would later turn up on the riverfront.
Well, how did that vote go?
Well, the vote went rather well. I believe 71% voted officially for the bond issue, so it had the imprimatur of the people all of a sudden. But the Post-Dispatch started looking at the details of that election and won a Pulitzer, actually, at night 2 years later for the kind of investigative reporting into some of the precincts. In one precinct, the vote was 505-0. And I think 34 other precincts, the bond issue received over 97% of the vote. So in some areas, it was almost unanimous. And in looking at the details of it, there were thousands of voters who were registered in empty parking lots or abandoned buildings. And so even the Post-Dispatch later on said, removed their validation of this project based on what they found in this election. But despite the evidence and despite people like Paul Peters and many others around here who said this just can't, you know, surface, still courts refused to invalidate the election, and things proceeded.
So the whole project really got started on the basis of a fraudulent election.
Well, that's what a lot of other newspapers and members of Congress felt, that this did not have the backing of the people of St. Louis. And you can see why. Asking people to take on a $7.5 million debt, and that means other projects would not be able to get that kind of funding, was a lot to ask. And so there was a great deal of opposition wondering why demolish this property. And the answer was jobs. The city had these huge flyers that said 5,111 jobs would be coming to St. Louis just weeks after the election. Now, that's a hard thing to turn down. But there were still many skeptics who thought this is an outrageous amount of money to be spending on something we don't even know what we're going to be getting with it.
And a lot of people who were saying we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater because those 40 square blocks included some important history of their own.
There were a lot of historic preservationists who said, hold on. You've got some of the greatest cast iron buildings anywhere in the world right here. I quote Charles Peterson of the National Park Service, who described the whole process in one word, horror. He thought that this was just a horrific thing to be doing, to just tear it down without even an idea of what's going to be built afterward. And once those blocks were gone, you're not getting them back. And so today, I think, ironically, a lot of city planners are trying to, you know, capitalize on those kinds of properties, those old kind of buildings where people can live and work and shop and eat and walk.
What happened to the cast iron? Do we know?
It was placed in various facilities. It was supposed to be preserved. Most of it wasn't. But those buildings, some of them were presidential nominations inside some of these buildings. They were some of the greatest buildings this side of the Mississippi. They were gone forever. But the notion was we need to progress. And in the name of progress, a lot of things are going to be demolished.
So ironically, what was destroyed was precisely the kind of thing that the National Park Service should have wanted to preserve.
In some measure. Now, that's not to say that every building, every block was pristine and beautiful. I mean, because you can look at the photographs and see some areas are hard hit, but it's hard to find any city in 1935 that doesn't have blocks like that. This was an economic cataclysm. But, you know, in a lot of cities, we'll be having outdoor cafes and working and office buildings that were built many years ago, and they now have that kind of quote-unquote charm.
Was there a racism element to the decision-making?
I think it's impossible to look at anything like this without bringing in race. It's kind of the thread that runs throughout so many issues of American history, particularly in the 20th century. It has to be there. And race played its own role in the Gateway Arch and in the rebuilding of the riverfront. A number of African American labor leaders wondered what's in it for us to support this 1935 bond issue. The Argus, a great newspaper, finally came out in support because they just couldn't oppose the notion that jobs would be coming. But to maybe get ahead of the story, when the jobs actually came in the 1960s, there was no room for African Americans working on the Arch Project.
We'll be talking about the role Percy Green and others played during that part of the story a little bit later. I'd like to follow it kind of chronologically. That's sometimes difficult to do. Tracy Campbell is my guest. He has written the book, The Gateway Arch. It's a fascinating story, as I'm sure you've determined by now, of how this whole Gateway Arch project got started and how it unfolded is coming up next. We'll be back with Tracy Campbell in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion with Tracy Campbell, the author of The Gateway Arch, which is obviously the story of The Gateway Arch. Tracy, we've talked a little bit about the background and the fact it's been established that all of this was done, the demolition of the 40 square blocks, without really knowing what they wanted to do. That brings us to the competition to try to come up with an idea what to put in that area. It all started for the winning entrant, Eero Saarinen, with pipe cleaners.
Right. Yeah. Keep in mind, the competition is starting in 1947, 12 years after the original bond issue election. Second World War, of course, interrupted any plans for any kind of city development. So after the war, the city of St. Louis thought about how do we rebuild this. Now, they took a chance on an architectural competition. Mm-hmm. What you could do, like you do today, is maybe go to Frank Gehry or somebody and say, here's the plan, do what you think's best. And you've got a big name, and we'll see what he produces. A competition, you're rolling the dice. You don't know who will apply. You don't know the level of, you know, mediocrity you might face. And so St. Louis had the first major architectural competition after the Second World War. It was in two stages. They would boil it down to the five finalists, and then ask those five finalists to perhaps redo or refashion their entries and then announce a winner.
This is following an open competition.
An open competition. 172 entries come in. And for Errol Saarinen, I thought it was fascinating his background before he gets to 1947. He's from Finland. His father is one of the world's most noted architects. His mother's a sculptor. And he grows up in this remarkable household in outside Helsinki called Vitrask, where there's architects, there's planners, there's artists. He grows up just thinking, and you know, it's in his very DNA. But he also wants to get from behind the shadow of his looming father, who, like I said, was really a giant in world architecture. And so the Gateway Arch was really his first chance to enter a competition separate from his father and to establish his own name, which was really the driving force of his whole professional career, was to be a huge name, something that could maybe eclipse even that of his father, and to leave a lasting imprint on American architecture.
Did his father enter the competition too?
His father sure did. They worked separately. And the, one of the best-known stories, and it's true, is that when the five finalists were announced, a telegram was sent to the Saarinen office, and everyone assumed it was the father, Elio. And so there's a celebration, and then a second one arrived saying, no, it's for Eero, which for the son must have been a very satisfying moment to watch everything kind of turn 180 degrees and the attention finally turn to him. Saarinen designed some of the great buildings of his day, but he's probably best known today for his furniture designs and for the Gateway Arch, which I think at the end of the day is a work of sculpture, as well as his furniture designs. And he had battled these two notions in his head as a young man, whether to become an architect or a sculptor. And on a few projects, he managed to be able to do both.
Right. Well, he won the competition, obviously. But again, I made the reference to the pipe cleaners. We better let folks know what that was all
okay.
about.
One of his friends was another well-known, legendary designer named Charles Eames from St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And Eames came to him in Michigan and told him about this project. And Eames knew St. Louis about as well as anyone. And what they did was get on the floor of Saarinen's house and start playing around with pipe cleaners, which they could bend, and maybe several arches that formed at various places. But they just kept, you know, experimenting with these various kinds of forms. Now, Eames submitted his own entry and wasn't a finalist, but Saarinen kept thinking about a grand triumphal arch that could mark the gateway to the West.
Why an arch?
That's a good question. The jury noted that when they first saw Saarinen's plan, it produced a quote-unquote peculiarly happy feeling. And there is something, even when you go down there today, people seem to enjoy and feel happy about seeing this beautiful work of art. It produces smiles rather than, you know, tears, which a lot of monuments or memorials often do. Saarinen had seen a lot of arches when he had traveled through Europe. He'd seen them in dirigible hangars. He had seen examples in the Middle East. He had seen examples like from Le Corbusier. And so the arch was somehow in his mind a lot, and he said that these were universal concepts. And what fascinated me was that the notion of arches along the Mississippi River here in St. Louis kept coming up over and over again well before we ever got to Errol Saarinen.
Eads Bridge.
1915, an architect named J.L. Weiss came up with an idea of a grand triumphal arch on right about where the Gateway Arch is now, but it was more of the arch you would see in Paris or New York. A high school student named Geneva Abbott in 1933 for her local yearbook drew this picture of what she thought St. Louis would look like in the future. And over, you know, she framed the city with this giant arch. Engineers had come up with an idea of a gateway to the West that would be some kind of triumphal arch. So it was kind of ironic that it just kept popping up over and over again, well before Saarinen.
And structurally, the arch is important because of its strength, that attribute.
Well, the fact that so many still exist, you know, from Greek and Roman examples, yeah, show that it's an extremely strong form, which should give people who go to the top of it, you know, a feeling of confidence, because it is a very strong structure.
A lot of people made fun of the idea.
Oh, endless fun. It was hard to boil down the number of names, derogatory names that were used when they first saw the examples, whether it's in the Post-Dispatch or other newspapers, you know, croquet wicket, the back door to the east. Some saw it as a communist-inspired example, thinking that Saarinen was somehow from another country, he must be a communist.
Well, let's stop it right there, because there was a lot of criticism of his having used this particular design, the ultimate design, because a similar project had been unveiled in Italy in honor of Mussolini, as I recall.
Well, about a week after his final plan is announced and he's congratulated as having won this competition, the New York Herald Tribune says, wait a minute, he stole the design. And they use this image, and I have it in the book. It's quite an image.
It looks just like what we have downtown.
It's from the Rome Exposition of 1942 by an architect named Adalberto Libera, who said that was my arch. It was going to be a giant freestanding arch that would welcome visitors into Rome, and it was going to be a monument to fascism and to Mussolini. At first, Saarinen just dismissed it and said, I've never saw it. I never thought anything about it. But when the criticism got, you know, hot enough, he finally had to respond and say that he had never seen it. It was a very different kind of arch. And that arches are so universal that no one should be able to claim authorship of one particular form. So for Saarinen, that could have been the great crisis that would have ended everything. But he was able to weather that.
What do you think? I mean, you've spent a lot of time looking into all of this, and Mr. Saarinen was a difficult man by most accounts.
Do I think he stole it?
Yeah.
I don't.
No.
I don't have, you know, looking at the evidence and the Saarinen papers at Yale, there's a huge file about this, and it's going from lawyer to lawyer, various people getting involved. When you look at the two arches, they're different. The one in Rome was going to be more like a rainbow. And Saarinen, from the very beginning, rejected any ideas of a rainbow. He wanted it to be seen as soaring from the ground rather than being placed on it. Saarinen's final design was three-sided and rather elegant. The one that was in Rome is four-sided and kind of used the term clunky.
It's the legs we're talking
right about.
Yeah.
And it's a very different looking thing, and it's much more imposing, the one in Rome. The one that Saarinen designed, like I said, is much more sleek and elegant and inspiring, if I could use that phrase. And it's more beautiful. So I didn't see any examples of Saarinen having stolen anything from Italy.
From the get-go, and it persists to this day, although there are plans afoot to correct it. The recessed highway was a problem and has been a problem. How did they approach that in the day?
Well, if you look at the design competition, cars are built into the very structure of that competition. And that was a thing that most American cities saw as an antidote to decaying cities, and that is bring more highways in, particularly if there's an interstate highway system that's ever developed. You want to bring it right in the middle of the city. That'll bring in shoppers and tourists galore. So in the very structure of the competition are these series of highways that kind of bisect the memorial grounds from the city. And there were some voices. It was interesting to hear these voices from the 30s and the 40s saying, do we really want to do this? Will this be a problem down the road? And they were kind of dismissed really as being cranks who opposed the whole idea of progress. But those highways, of course, have proven to be a problem that we're still trying to fix as far as the entrance to the park.
Sure. It separates the arch from the rest of the city. And,
mm-hmm.
and actually what they wanted to do from the very beginning, as I understand it, was to tie the two together.
Right. And one of the people I mentioned in this book I found fascinating was an architect named Harris Armstrong from St. Louis, mm-hmm. who in 1944, before anything else, was asked by a magazine, if you could do anything you wanted with this St. Louis riverfront, what would you think of? And he came up with some interesting ideas. He said, forget the whole idea of a memorial. Buy the land back from the government and make this usable for people. And he wanted a grand plaza from the river all the way to the old courthouse where people could walk. There'd be usable grounds. as well as some ideas that look a little strange today, like a landing strip for people to land their private airplanes, kind of like in a Jetsons-like type of world. But there are still a lot of interesting architects and engineers and planners thinking of other ways to go about doing this to kind of bring the city and the river together again.
The feeling at the time, again, I'm drawing upon my recollection in the book, was that the automobile and the airplane were the future.
Yes.
And if you could tie anything into the two of those things, that would make it better.
Well, Saarinen knew that to win that competition, he needed a structure that could be seen from miles away from people entering in automobiles. So a lot of interesting design concepts that look good maybe from the ground for people walking around were dismissed by the jury. They wanted something to really impress people. And boy, they were right. Even in a plane as you're landing in St. Louis, the arch is impressive from the air, and you can see it for miles, of course, as you're approaching by land from a car. So friendliness to cars was built kind of into the very structure of the arch and the arch competition.
Another area I want to touch upon in the chronology of it, I'm not exactly sure where it stands. I think it's probably a little bit later. But part of what I'm about to say I always thought was urban myth, but apparently it's not to a large degree, and that's Walt Disney's interest in that real estate. Tell us about that interest and how that evolved.
You know, one of the fun things about being a historian is you just never know where the evidence is going to take you. And in looking through the newspapers, as the arch is under construction, all of a sudden here appears Walt Disney. And I thought, looking through it, this will last for a couple of days or so. But instead, it's a real interest in possibly developing a second Disneyland in St. Louis. He'd already built one in California, looking for a second one. And he had his planners draw up financial reports, feasibility studies, and then actual blueprints for something that would be called Riverfront Square. That would be a five-story-like structure close to the arch that would have St. Louis history, Main Street, kind of things he was doing in California, robots that would, you know, act like historic characters. And another part of the urban legend is that August Bush Jr. destroyed it by saying that beer would have to be sold at it.
Exactly. Is that true?
Well, I think money was much more a factor.
Okay.
That's kind of who I am as a historian, as someone looking at economics, because both sides, the city and Disney, thought the other was going to pay for this. Disney's side thought that bonds would be floated, and once they were retired, Disney would own the property. The city thought it should own the property. There's another school of thought that thinks maybe the whole thing was a ruse, that while he's visibly making St. Louis the subject of a second St. Louis, he's privately buying up a lot of land in Central Florida, which I would think those would probably have much more strength to them as explanations rather than an offhanded comment about whether beer would be sold.
Yeah, that was all being done very quietly, the Florida acquisitions,
right.
Was it not?
Right. Oh, yes. No one knew exactly who was behind all that. No.
It is interesting to think what that downtown area might have been like had Mr. Disney followed through on that plan.
Right. It's a fun thing to think of as whether the city would have enjoyed a rebirth, it would certainly have a much different identity than today. Maybe there would be other things, though, we wouldn't expect that could have been, a disaster. I don't know.
But it would have served to draw people down to the arch. I mean, 3 million people a year visit the arch. That's a lot of people. But you go down, you look at it, you take a couple of pictures, maybe you go up to the top, and then you leave.
Right. With Disney's proposal, like I said, I'm not sure how close they really were. I don't want you to think they got to the river's edge and came very close to it. That would be one interesting thing to have asked Mr. Disney if he were around. How close were you? But the whole question is, what do you do after you visit the arch? Where do you go? And that was something people struggled with in the 60s. It's what we struggle with today.
You say that this really kind of added to urban decay. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I meant was the answer in so many cities, friendliness to automobiles, maybe a baseball stadium, parking garages, the car would be the answer to all of our problems. And St. Louis did that as well as so many other cities. Fill in the blank, how many other cities tried that route. St. Louis tried something else with this 630-foot-tall tourist attraction, which was designed to try and help rebuild the city as well. But instead, like I said, I think by destroying 40 square blocks and by focusing so much on this one structure, a lot of things were left aside that we're still trying to fix today.
Yeah. I want to get into the construction itself because that's certainly a fascinating part of the story, but we have to take another break. My guest in studio is the author of The Gateway Arch, a biography. It is subtitled. Tracy Campbell is with us in studio. We'll continue our conversation and talk about how the arch was constructed and some of the challenges that were faced during that time. They were considerable. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Tracy Campbell, the author of The Gateway Arch, subtitled The Gateway Arch, A Biography. Okay, let's get to the construction as time begins to move along, Tracy. Many, many challenges. Give us some sense of what those challenges were.
Well, no structure quite like it had ever built before or since. You're going to have to build a continuously curved environment. And how it would be built, how it would sustain itself, and the interior elevators. You know, it's like going to the moon, and I found myself sometimes thinking this was kind of a space-age project. Let's get started, and let's let the engineers and somebody else figure it out as we go. And insurance underwriters thought that at least 13 people would die. You know, this is before OSHA regulations. They're not wearing harnesses. They're working in continuously enclosed environments. And in the St. Louis summers, you can imagine how hot it was. And people got tilted and weren't sure what's vertical or what's plumb. And it was a very dangerous working environment. Miraculously, no one died during the entire building process.
They really had to fly by the seat of their pants, too, didn't they, in trying to figure out how to do certain things. And some of this was done as they were doing it.
Right. The notion was from the very beginning there should be interior elevators to give people something to do once they arrived at the arch. How do you build elevators, though, that can operate in a curved environment? Because if you start vertical, by the time you get up to the top, you're going to be on your side. So SARNA never really came up with an answer, and it wasn't until much, much later that an engineer named Dick Bowser came up with the idea that these cars should pivot like a Ferris wheel car. But he wasn't brought in until well late in the date. Otis Elevator, a number of other companies, had tried to come up with ideas of maybe having a series of elevators that would stop you, get off, move a little bit further, but it wasn't until Dick Bowser came up with this ingenious idea of pivoting from the top and letting these cars roll to I hope I can describe it as well. I'm not an engineer, but the cars will pivot like you would in a Ferris wheel until you get near the top, get out, and then you can look at the city from the top and then get back in the cars whenever you want and go back down.
Looking back at it, it seems fairly simple.
It always is once it's done.
Yeah.
But Bowser, like I said, was brought in almost as they're building this thing to figure out, is there a way we can get people to the top?
Why stainless steel?
Stainless steel, well, as we now know, it's not stainless.
Yes, we knew to know that.
At first, Saarinen talked about a concrete arch, and that's kind of a scary thing to think of, to have a concrete arch, the way it would look, the way it would weather, the way it would age. There were other ideas, and stainless steel was still very new as far as a building project. You know, it wasn't used. It's very expensive, and it is certainly in the spire of the Chrysler Building. But this was one of the largest purchases of stainless steel ever. It's strong, it's beautiful, and the notion was that it would look seamless all the way to the top. And stainless steel was something to attract the eyes of the jury. And I hope our listeners understand that if he can't convince the jurors in that architectural competition that this is a beautiful project, it doesn't matter.
Well, again, looking back, some of these things seem relatively simple when you have the advantage of hindsight. We mentioned Percy Green and some of the labor problems that developed during the construction. Let's briefly go over that, and then we'll move on to some other things I'd like to talk about. There was considerable demonstration at the arch.
Well, the arch, of course, is being built in the early 60s, in which a lot of other things are going on throughout the country. And even though it was proposed as a huge jobs project, when the arch is under construction in the early 60s, it's a whites-only project. And when civil rights organizers asked the NPS about this, the NPS said, well, the trade unions are the ones responsible for this. The trade unions said, well, nobody's going to our schools to learn this trade who are of color. So everybody kept passing the buck. And so there was a famous sit-in at the Arch by two civil rights protesters, Percy Green among them. But there were other moments with the building of the Arch that have to do with issues almost out of today's newspaper, dealing with affirmative action, or the government saying that if, you know, there ought to be a certain number of African American firms hired on the project. But still, it, you know, 1966, even after the Arch is finished, the underground museum is being built, when just a few African American plumbers were given contracts for working down there, a number of white workers walked off the job in kind of in protest. So the Arch is symbolic of a lot of things. I also think it's symbolic of a lot of broken racial promises here in St. Louis.
And as a matter of fact, many of the same issues remain in this community today.
Yes.
There is no question mm-hmm. about it. Let's see. What else did I want to – oh, the Mansion House part of the story, where Saarinen flexed his muscles. They wanted to build a huge high-rise that would have blocked the view to the city.
Yes. You know, you wonder – it's 630 feet tall. How did they arrive at it? Is it a mathematical formula? Is there something magical to it? It's actually a political compromise. Saarinen did not want any buildings nearby to compete with the Arch. He wanted it to be like the Washington Monument in Washington, where there would only be one thing you could look up and see. But, of course, developers wanted to take advantage of the Arch and build something nearby. And the Mansion House projects proposed by Lewis Kitchen were going to be much higher. Saarinen opposed it. And so the compromise was, forget just how high the Mansion House
project. 42 stories.
42 stories, but then the original Arch project, which is going to be 590 feet, was raised to 630.
And the Mansion House was reduced in size. It never achieved
exactly
42 stories.
But still, the notion was visually to keep the Arch by itself so it would kind of stand out, which it doesn't really do today as well as Saarinen probably would have hoped. But, you know, that's an architect. You know, cities have to decide what they want to do, and the architect's needs are certainly important, but as well as what the city and developers want.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that the architect's influence would wane once the project is accepted, once the design is there, and once the construction begins. He's kind of out of the picture.
But Saarinen was kind of bigger than life. I mean, he was on the cover of Time magazine in 1956 as the vanguard of modern architecture, and cities and clients almost kind of rolled over backwards. He was very good with clients. He wasn't like Frank Lloyd Wright, who would say it's my way or the highway. He would work with them. He would compromise. But still, people just didn't want to oppose him too much because he really had this kind of larger-than-life aura about him by the late 1950s.
And as far as what's going on today, they're correcting or attempting and proposing to correct a number of the problems, principally the recessed highway, to mm-hmm. find a way to deal with that. I guess after your research, that probably makes you happy.
Well, I don't know. Yes, I think cities all around the country are trying to find ways to take areas back from automobiles. What I've read, and I'm not a city planner, but what I've read, like the books like The Walkable City and many others, is that we need to focus now more on sidewalks and places where people live rather than buildings or highways. And this looks like an attempt, from what I've seen, to reclaim a part of that valuable piece of property away from the automobile and to give it something where people can walk. The next question will then be, where do they walk to?
Well, that remains to be answered, but I know what the planners are hoping is going mm-hmm. to happen, a lot more traffic. You have written that St. Louis's have never considered it a vital part of the city. Let me read you something that came into my Facebook page today, if I can find it. A gentleman by the name of Ed wrote, "It's the most overblown, overfunded, and underperforming of all monuments. Where we are today, a severely compromised downtown with crumbling infrastructure and just about out of the convention and tourism business, dead during the wintertime." That's pretty reflective of what you wrote.
Well, those were his words, but yeah, I think there have been a lot of problems produced by this, you know, this maniacal notion of just building one particular thing. On the other hand, if I can contradict myself, Now, in the 21st century, as St. Louis thinks about where it wants to go, it has an asset that no other city has. And all you have to do is go there on any evening and see the people who just want to be near it, they want to be next to it, and they want to walk around it. That is an asset that, you know, city planners and city leaders need to think how to best utilize that. And I know that's on their minds. So, but when we talk about terms of maintenance and that all human structures need work and need some kind of cleaning and need some kind of maintenance, the arch is going to be a challenge in ways that engineers are going to struggle with how you clean it, how you maintain it, how do you fix problems.
We should point out you're not anti-arch. You've written a lot of things about it that is history and the truth about how all of this came in. There's always a backstory.
Well, no, I'm not anti-arch. I think it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I spent 8 years of my life researching it. And so something about it just kind of got inside me. And the notion that this is a magnificent work of art. And like I said, it produces this kind of feeling. I almost called the book Saarinen's Cathedral, that it was a secular kind of cathedral, that when people go there, they just look up, they get kind of quiet, they think about other things. It's a different kind of feeling than you get, say, if you go to Mount Rushmore or, say, the Lincoln Memorial. It's a different kind of memorial. And it touches people emotionally. And the jury understood that from the very beginning. So that was what kind of drove me from the first place to understand it.
And somebody must like it because 3 million people a year are going down there. I mean, obviously, it's a wonderful structure. But it's got a story like all of us and like most things.
Yeah.
Let me read you another note I have here. In November 2006 on Weekend Edition, host Scott Simon said, on this date in 1965, workers topped out the final section of the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, the world's best-known parabola. The program received a lot of feedback, so much so that they made an on-air correction the following week. What is the difference between a parabolic arch and a catenary arch?
I'll try and put it as simple as I know. A parabolic arch is more like a rainbow. A catenary, as I think is defined, you take two sides of a chain and let them drop and invert it, and that's what the catenary arch, like the arch down at the river, looks like. But I'd also say that Saarinen didn't want a parabolic arch, but he also didn't just go with a mathematical formula. He kept what he called eyeballing it, and just getting just the right taper and the right kind of form, because for him this was a work of sculpture. And one of the pictures I used was of a model he had sculpted back when he was a child. He always liked curved forms. He always liked dealing with sculpture, and he kept eyeballing, as he said, the arch through countless, countless models just to get it to look just right.
I have another email here. This one is from Tom. It says, the museum located under the Gateway Arch is called the Museum of Westward Expansion. Isn't that name misleading, since it gives the impression that President Jefferson acquired the and Lewis and Clark explored all of the U.S. west of the Mississippi? Does the museum perhaps ignore the western territorial acquisitions of President Polk, because Polk obtained most of that other land?
Well, perhaps so, but, you know, the museum down underneath the arch was kind of an afterthought. In the original arch competition, there were going to be museums, there were going to be helicopter landing pads, all kinds of things that were eventually removed from the surface, and Saarinen was able to place them underground. And so what various people get out of museums, of course, is one thing, but history is about asking questions, about looking for evidence, finding things you might be troubled by, some things that might make you feel glorious. But at the end of the day, having to kind of come to grips with those things.
Why did it take so long from design to start of construction?
Well,
19 years or so.
After I finished, I actually thought, how did it ever get built? It's kind of amazing that it did. Mm-hmm. The money, the political will, the ability to actually construct the thing, it had to be a correct confluence of events. And at the end of the day, I thought this monument is probably more a monument to the 20th century than to the 19th, that it was built between World War II and when we landed on the moon, when the United States was at its financial and military and political peak and could do audacious things like this architecturally. The notion of clearing 40 square blocks and building something like that today would would be laughed at financially. We can't even repair our own roads and bridges today.
One of the things that struck me, and we've alluded to it in this discussion, was the fact that so much was unresolved even after the point where construction started. We talked about the elevators. You just mentioned that the museum was kind of an afterthought. This struck me as very, very odd. Again, flying by the seat of their pants. Well, let's have a museum, that sort of thing.
Well, the notion was give people something to do besides just ride to the top. And there's a lot of great things to do down there. You can see a film. You can go to, you know, to shops and the like. But there had to be something underneath it. They just didn't want to build, you know. From the very beginning, the Gateway Arch planners thought of something called a living museum, which was really a kind of ahead of their time in thinking in terms of museums. That this just shouldn't be statues and old relics, that it should be something people experience.
Sort of like what Disney was apparently thinking about.
Exactly.
But when did they start to build a museum? And where was the arch in terms of construction?
Well, the museum was built after the arch was finally finished. The arch is finished in October 65, but even in 66, 67, we've got a lot of underground construction. That would finally be dedicated in 1968. So a lot of work went on underground even after the arch was finally finished.
What did you find to be the most fascinating aspect of all of this, given all your research, 8 years of research?
That's hard to answer. Yeah. I was fascinated by the politics. I was fascinated by Saarinen. Fascinated by the people saying no. And if I got past the notion of these are cranks standing in the way of progress and thinking, what are they saying? Why are they opposing this? What do they want built anyway? It sounded like out of today's newspapers. They wanted places where people could walk and eat and shop and work, and they wanted neighborhoods. Some were opposing the highways. The Disney part kind of fascinated me. The construction part, it's hard to answer which thing, because that was the fun part of this book. Just when I thought this doesn't get any better, the evidence would lead me somewhere else that was equally compelling.
Harry Truman was president when this design competition was taking place, and for several years thereafter. Did he have any kind of a significant role in all of this?
Well, of course, he not only, but a lot of other people who you think might have opposed this kind of very modernist structure immediately loved it. And Truman came here in 1950 actually to dedicate the whole project.
In 1950.
Just a few weeks, though, before the Korean War started. And he gave a speech here about the Cold War that kind of has the kind of foreshadowing of what we would see in Korea. Once the Korean War started, the notion of huge expenditures for a project like this had to be, you know, tabled until many years later.
Wars got in the way. That wasn't the first war to get in the way. Obviously, from the time of the bond vote in St. Louis, World War II intervened before that competition.
World War II, then Korea, and who knows if there had been any more delay, what the Vietnam War would have done. So like I said, it was really, there was this short window of time in which the funding could occur in the late 50s, early 60s, and the construction would be finished by about 1965.
And what ultimately was the final cost?
Roughly, it's hard to get a good figure about that, but it's somewhere below $30 million. But if you include the various things that came in underneath it, it's somewhere in the 30s or 40s. But we actually got it pretty cheap, actually.
Yeah. One final thought. We only have a few seconds left. I just want another word on Saarinen. This guy had a pretty big ego and very quirky kind of life.
He had an amazing mind. He could draw with two hands independent of each other at the same time. He had this trait called mirror writing, where he could write a letter backward and you could put it up to a mirror and it's exactly, I mean exactly like his normal handwriting.
As did Leonardo da Vinci. Yeah.
But he sat for a series of interviews in the late 50s at the University of California, Berkeley, and they concluded that he had some pretty dark elements that, you know, kind of pushed people aside, that he was driven by this need to be a bigger-than-life architect, and human beings, particularly women, were kind of subjected to inferior statuses and which he treated people with some contempt at times.
If people want to know more about Eros Saarinen or more about the background of the Gateway Arch and what's going on today, they can certainly do so by reading the book, The Gateway Arch, by our guest, Tracy Campbell. Tracy, again, congratulations. I love the book. Most interesting. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back tomorrow. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.